sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Well, good day. Hello. How are you? This is Andrew Horowitz, and boy, am I beat. I have been traveling. I have been going. I have been doing it and speaking. It's been the roughest 3 weeks that I can remember in a long time. Anyway, you're listening to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. It's episode number 70. And I was over in California last week. I was at the Money Show speaking with the MSN Strategy Lab panel. I had my own class. That was pretty cool. Thanks so much for everybody that did show up and did ask me about my rubber toilet seats. There was plenty of you. We gave out some books, had a good time there. I spent a couple of days in that area and had some meetings. Actually, spent some time at my friend Leo Laporte. He has a studio up in Petaluma and spent some time on his podcast. We had a great time. Myself, Jason Calacanis, Peter from the Business Week, technical writer for Business Week. And we spent a lot of time. If you haven't heard it, it was a great, great podcast. Go over to twit.tv. And download the latest podcast over there where you'll see me called Beard Daddies. Look for Beard Daddies. You'll know what it is when you get there. And then I went down to Apple and met with Scott over at the iTunes platform. That was kind of neat. And then went up to the mothership of Microsoft and met with the whole MSN Money team and had a day with them and an evening with them. What a great time with my good friends up there. And lots of good things happening that you're going to hear about soon with me and the Microsoft Money, MSN Money. Of course, I've been working on the Strategy Lab. You can check that out. But what I thought we'd do today is I need to follow up on something that's been bugging me. A long time ago, I mentioned that, I mentioned that there is a problem in the heating oil area. And that was sparked by the discussion with Professor Greenberger, who brought us the whole Enron loophole issue. And if you've been investing along at home, if you will, you've made a lot of money on Doug. We're up about 32, 33% on the original recommendation, and in our portfolio, somewhere about 22% on Doug. And that's the inverse 200% of the oil and gas sector. And obviously, as oil has dropped down to the 112, 113 mark, depending where when you're listening to this, the fact is that these oil companies are in a real pickle because they're not going to be earning money like they used to. But nonetheless, we have I thought I would call him because there's been something bothering me about the fact that I had been understanding that Morgan Stanley had been, as they say, cornering the market in the Northeast for heating oil. And kind of, it was a really kind of an undertone, a discussion, and question what was going to happen if that occurred. And wouldn't you know it, just yesterday in Bloomberg, they reported that the Northeast is going to have the worst winter in terms of cost of heating oil. And even though heating oil around the country is going to be the highest level it's ever been, the Northeast is going to be almost 60% higher or so. Now, how does that happen? How is it just one sector that's going to have this problem? Well, if you continue on the discussion that there is a company that is cornering the market and driving up prices, looking for profit on speculation and manipulation of the market, well, hello, that's what happens. So we're going to get him on the phone. We have it lined up in a second to get him on the phone. And then we're going to get into a discussion about the automobile industry, how to fix the automobile industry, which I don't have the answers to, but I have an idea on just a couple of things that may be beneficial. And thank you for so many people writing me in and talking to me about, you know, how they would fix the automobile industry. A lot of people gave me some really good ideas and some good leads on how to track down some experts in the area as well. So with that, let's get into this discussion. We get back. I'm going to give a call. We're going to talk to Professor Greenberger, the original gentleman who was on the CTFC commission and who has really riled Congress and brought Congress to action on the whole Enron loophole, cutting down and closing down most of the loophole, which ended the rampant speculation that we saw and manipulation in the energy markets, particularly on the Intercontinental Commodity Exchange. So sit back. We'll be right back. We'll be going to talk, and I think it's going to be a great episode. Thanks for joining me. Thanks for subscribing. Hey, how about telling a friend? Do me a favor. Two things, actually. Will you tell a friend about the podcast if you enjoy it and continue to spread the news? Last week, we did hit number one. Thanks to Leo Laporte and his army, they hit us up pretty good and moved that podcast really way up on iTunes. If you haven't done so, please go to iTunes. Please, please, please go to iTunes and put in a review. All you have to do is go to the iTunes and click the Disciplined Investor Podcast and just put a comment and review there. I really appreciate it. That's very helpful to hear feedback of what you think is going on and how you like the show, et cetera, and what your thoughts are. So anyway, without further ado, we'll be right back on the Disciplined Investor Podcast, episode 70 with Professor Greenberger, talking about heating oil and the oil mess and see what he has to say. Thanks for joining us. We'll be right back. Hang on. So many times when we're creating these podcasts, we have to meet with people, talk with them, and plan. Oftentimes, it's best to do it in person, but if you can't do that, the next best thing is GoToMeeting. If you haven't tried GoToMeeting, the easiest and most affordable way to hold online meetings, you probably don't know how easy it is. Here's how it works. First, you sign up for free. It's a free trial. It takes like 2 minutes. Then you schedule an online meeting in advance or just on the fly. Then you simply invite friends or family or even business associates to an online meeting. That's it. It's all you have to do. Use GoToMeeting for presentations, collaborating, training, or even product demos. Try the GoToMeeting free right now for 30 days. For this special offer, you must go to www.gotomeeting.com/podcasts. That's gotomeeting.com/podcasts for your free trial. Check it out. And we are with Professor Michael Greenberger, who was with us about a month and a half ago, talking about the Enron loophole and all the shenanigans that were going on in the oil markets. And since then, Professor, where are we? How have things been, and how have you been, and what's happened with the oil markets?
Well, the oil markets have taken a, from my perspective, and I think from the economy's perspective, a very substantial dive. My memory is on July 17th, which was the day that Harry Reid introduced the Senate bill to increase regulation of speculation in these markets. Oil was at around 147.
Mm-hmm.
Today, it's beginning to look like it's going to touch 110. So that's a 37-point drop in less than a month.
But there's no speculation going on. That's just demand, right?
Well, my view is, and I think that some of economists have opined over this dramatic drop, and it's just not just oil, it's a lot of natural gas and a lot of other commodities that I believe were part of a speculative inflation of prices have dropped. And I really don't think the supply-demand factor has changed all that much. The economists and financial papers are always quick to point out an event here, an event there. But one of the most dramatic events, which was the Russian invasion of Georgia.
Yeah, it didn't do anything. As a matter of fact, it backed off, which was unbelievable.
Yes, and prior to July 17th, that would have been an occasion, much like the day of June 6th, where the market just skyrocketed on any excuse. And had we been in other times, I think the occasion of that Russian intervention would have been cause for the speculators to pump up the heat, using that as the excuse for why the price is going up. Since July 17th, there have been an enormous observation and circling around the speculation problem. The CFTC, which is, you know, has dragged its feet over this issue forever, brought a manipulation case against traders on the NYMEX.
Was that the ones out of the Netherlands?
Yes.
That was a joke. That was they were saying that they profited by like $1 million.
Yeah. But well, even though that was not a substantial set of facts, the message is going out to speculators that the wagons are circling. The CFTC has been forced by Congress to impose speculation limits on the Intercontinental Exchange and on the Dubai Exchange. The FTC, just a few days ago, has issued its own manipulation proposed rule, which was dictated by Congress in December of 2007. They've been given authority to go in and look at these markets, both the physical side and the future side, and they wrote a very, very tough rule that is going to enable the FTC to get in this. So you're going to end up with competition among two federal agencies as to who is going to do a better job. But from my perspective, the overriding thing has happened. We came very close to passing a Senate bill The Senate Democrats couldn't break Republican filibuster, but they did get 50 votes out of 93 senators who were in town at the time. The House came within 6 votes of getting 2/3 a vote to get a House bill through. The House bill wasn't as strong as the Senate bill, but it had teeth in it. And I think the polling is starting to show that the public is on to this issue, and speculation is now on the radar screen of the average American citizen. You're starting to see political ads where candidates are saying they're going to get to the bottom of speculation. And what I'm trying to say is, while a hammer hasn't come down on this market, the wagons are circling, and I think the speculators are seeing that if they don't get out of this market on their own, at their own pace, they're going to be forced to get out of this market one way or the other. And so I think the bubble has been, the pin has pricked the balloon. The bubble is being deflated. One other thing, there was a massive holder of contracts on NYMEX that NYMEX forced to be recategorized as a speculative investment rather than a commercial investment. And that really sent waves through the market, because it shows that even NYMEX is getting tough on these issues and will be treating speculators as speculators and subjecting them to all the pressures and limits that should be applied to speculators in these markets. So I think, you know, the hard work that's been done by Congress, starting on June 3rd, with the hearing held by Senator Cantwell, where George Soros and I testified. I testified 6 times between June 3rd and July 12th, and I think the message has gotten through. The Washington Post had a front-page story that sovereign wealth funds are among the biggest speculators, and I'm told that that's been a very sobering message to Congress, that they had been given information that these were pension funds and endowments who were doing this, and now they're finding out it's sovereign wealth funds. Anyway, I'm hopeful that the jig may be up and that we're on a downturn here. Mm-hmm. I saw an article in the Wall Street Journal today that several economists are expecting a return to $90 a barrel of oil.
Well, now let me just interrupt for a moment, because I all of a sudden, you know, when I let's not minimize the effect that Congress. And let's not minimize the effect of what this podcast obviously had on Congress. Let's just state that fact, okay? When you were on last. But nonetheless, you know, the truth of the matter is, now we got this other thing going on. We got this whole other discussion. Nobody believed when there was speculation. No, there was no speculation. Back, we're only talking about a month and a half ago, you and I chatted,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely. Less than a month and a half ago.
We were lunatic fringed wackos, right? And mm-hmm. again, you know, and you were our God, if you will, right? You know, so thank you. But no, but seriously, what's interesting is that, number one, I don't remember the exact timeline here, but I think after that is when the Farm Bill passed. I think it was after that. The Farm Bill passed with the closing of the quote-unquote Enron loophole, and then I found out that it was still open for oil, which I almost fell out of my chair about. And it's still not closed, right?
It's still not closed. The Farm Bill's in the Enron loophole, which, you know, passed legislative activity. I think one of the important things that happened was it was made clear to Congress that that was not going to be an effective solution. And in fact, that measure is sort of off the radar screen now. We're so far beyond that measure, which was really not a very strong measure, and in my view, was really a measure that was written by the Intercontinental Exchange, right, which was one of the aiders and abettors of speculation. You know, that's gone. And one thing that has happened since Senator Cantwell's June 3rd hearing is the education of Congress itself. These markets were not well understood. The level of understanding has gone up tremendously. When you have a hearing now, the members come to the table, and they can't be buffaloed. They can't be given a lot of excuses. They know what's going on. Their constituents have been heard. For example, the airlines got frequent flyers to send 1.5 million email messages in around the beginning of July.
I got that email from American, actually.
Well, it's all having effect, and there are more commercial users of energy who are now all of a sudden saying, oh, so we're paying this price, not because of supply-demand, because of speculation, And every day, a new big Fortune 500 company is anting up to the table and saying, we're upset about this too. So the playing field has been leveled. The investment banks had this field to themselves. And I don't want to make the statement that the fight is over. It's not over. We can't let the progress that we've made, both intellectually, substantively, and in the real world, take our attention away from what we have to do. We have to finish this fight, and we have to make sure that not only Congress, but the executive branch stays on top of this. I think another very interesting thing that happened, the BBC ran a big investigative program yesterday on the laxity of commodity regulation by the Financial Services Authority that got tremendous press play in the United Kingdom. And frankly, you know, it's one thing to tighten things up here, which is going to be helpful, but we also, a lot of this trading goes on in London. Brent crude is traded over there, and I think it's going to become a hot political issue there, and the screws are going to be tightened harder.
Well, let me also say, I think that it's interesting that it was exactly at 145 that we had put the huge flag up and did a huge short on this and said, you know, from a financial standpoint, that we're going to obviously not take this and we're going to, you know, put our money where our mouth is. And that was the whole point about us buying a position in an inverse ETF. But the point is that I find fascinating about all this and actually scary. I'm not kidding, because whereas nobody believed it before, now everybody's starting, a lot of people are starting to move to the other side. I've been asked several times. I've been on many, many radio shows and written a piece that was in Business Week last week, and a piece in, although I don't think they used it in the Portfolio Magazine, the internal guy decided to write his own piece that it is all about supply-demand, which I'm having difficulty. See, by the way, let me say something, Professor. I believe that there is this quote-unquote speculation, but I also want to separate something. There's always going to be speculation. There's a difference between speculation and, let's call it, rampant and almost speculation to a point that it's manipulation. There's a difference. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, yes. I mean, the phrase we use and the phrase that the relevant legal phrase is excessive speculation.
Right.
And the point essentially is the markets can't function without speculators. But the other point is the speculators can't take the markets over. And there have been historic regulatory tools that were applied up through the passage of the Enron loophole that kept these markets functioning smoothly. Once you have markets that aren't subject to rules, the speculators have come in and they've taken the markets over, not only in the sense that they have become predominant, but they're driving commercial hedgers out of the market because the markets are so dysfunctional.
Yeah.
So rather than being what the futures markets were intended to be, as a hedging mechanism for people who are in the business of dealing with these commodities, what it's became is sort of a floating casino in the sky where you simply bet on the direction of a price of a commodity.
Right.
And it was not without a lot of forethought when the Enron loophole was passed that they also made sure that they preempted state gambling laws. Because essentially, once you're in there as a speculator, all you're doing is betting on the direction of prices.
Right.
And as you said, we do need speculation. But we can't have speculators take the markets over.
Yep.
And that was where we were in the middle of July. And hopefully that's where we're getting away from.
Right.
But I'm sure, as you understand, we can't take our eye off the ball. Because if we do, the prices will just go ramping back up again.
Yep. Well, let me just, this is a good segue to the last piece. This is really what I want to talk to you about. Was back when I had been talking about an interesting, and I won't say that it was absolutely specced out and proven by me, but there was a lot of anecdotal evidence that pointed to the fact that there was a lot of the financial guys, like a Goldman, like a Morgan, like these guys that were, you know, getting their butts cleaned, if you will, from this whole financial market mess, mortgages and subprime and auction rates that now they're going to have to be possibly paying for. And it seemed to me that there was a little bit of a trend going that they were entering into the oil and commodity markets to try to see if they can do what they can to push this all to, you know, incredible levels to profit from that, because it wasn't the other side. They need to fill in the other side, in other words. Now, my understanding, what I've read a tremendous amount about was that Morgan Stanley in particular was somewhat locking up the entire Northeast heating oil market. Do you know anything about that?
Well, I will tell you this, that if you talk to anybody who's in the heating oil market in New England, they will tell you that Morgan Stanley has very large physical supplies of heating oil. I know that I mentioned that in the June 3rd hearing. Morgan Stanley came back with talking points that they circulated around the Hill. One, those talking points said, well, we only hold 12%, but they never said, what is 12% in relation to everything else?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, 12% could still be the largest holder of heating oil. The other thing is my research assistants looked at their 10K, and they have control over other companies that are holding heating oil that I don't believe were reflected in the figures they were giving to the Hill. Let me say this. I don't want to pretend. I think this is a subject for further investigation, and I can assure you that between the oversight committees in Congress, the CFTC, which is reluctantly being beaten about the head to do something, and now the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, has just issued a very tough proposed rule. We will get to the bottom of all this. And the fact of the matter is, I think the fact that the cavalry is on the way here is the very reason that the market is correcting itself and becoming more associated with market fundamentals is everyone understands the rock has been picked up, the worms are going to be canted, and they want to get out from under that count. And I believe that's the reason we're seeing the price of oil and natural gas and metals and agricultural products starting to drop.
Well, in this morning's Bloomberg, I was reading an article that really the reason why it prompted me to say, oh, I need to talk about this was, and I'm trying to look for it right now, but basically there was this discussion about that the heating oil this winter is going to be extraordinary. Oh, no, it was Yahoo, front page Yahoo. The heating oil on its own is going to be the costliest it's ever been this winter, point one. Point two, heating oil, particularly in the Northeast, is going to be almost, I think it was close to 50 or 60% more than it would be anywhere else in the country. And I said, wait a second, hold on. Now we start adding up, you know, 1 plus 1 equals 17 these days, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I said, what's happening there? And it seemed to then tie out that if that's the case, I mean, we potentially are seeing the effects of a one company. And again, I think, you know, they have a reason to do so. But one company, you know, really being dominant in this area, and then we have this huge problem coming. And if
yes.
if they did in fact do this, if they did in fact corner this market, I wonder, you know, is this going to be, you know, is this going to be something we have to be really worried about moving forward? I just it's kind of concerning that piece.
Well, look, when you have these deregulation measures that took effect in 2000, you essentially what you're doing is guessing. Because they've arranged the markets so that they cannot be observed by the people who usually observe them, that is to say, the federal regulators. All of us are looking at data and making our best guesses, and of course, the Morgan Stanleys of this world come back and they say, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong. Well, they have the luxury of operating when all the lights are out, and they know what's happening, and no one else has a real fix. That is coming to an end. I mean, you know, the FTC just proposed a very tough rule to look at these markets, and they've adopted a standard of manipulation that is quite provable by federal authorities, and we're going to find out. I believe the jig is up, and I think the fact that the jig is up is why people are getting out of these markets, because they know they can't keep doing the things they're doing. And there are a lot of people, including even the CFTC itself, which, as I've said and I believe you've said, have not been terribly aggressive. They're looking at these markets, and they're talking about the relationship between physical holdings and the futures markets. And these matters are going to be looked at. It may not be next week, next month, but within the next year, there will be thorough investigations of these markets.
Well,
we'll know for sure.
As the last commentary in the piece that the CTFC put out, that they had discovered that there was no significant speculation at this time, and I almost threw up everywhere because.
Well, let me say that report has been deemed to be laughable. It's caused a tremendous amount of controversy. And the very fact that the ink was almost not dry on that thing, exactly. Congress and everyone attacked it, shows you we're in a new world. Yeah, they're not going to get by with a simple analysis that doesn't take into account a hard look at the data and the physical and futures market. That world has ended.
Yeah, but who's
they
in
can't
whose,
get by
professor,
with
professor, who's in whose pocket, though? That's what, and we don't have to drag this out, but you know what? When that kind of report comes out, and when they were just prior to that charged with this amazing ability to have open access, and it's only one time in the last five times in the history of their existence of the commodity markets to go after and to put a kibosh on rampant speculation, silver and cotton, all that over the years, right? And they get that broad-based power given to them, and then they come out with that sloppy report,
yeah.
Which, by the way, it could be that they're – I'm not suggesting that that's not the real findings. It was way too quick. It was way too absolute in a market that was clearly not that cut and dry. And then you say to yourself, who are they playing for? What team are these guys playing for?
Well, they haven't been playing for the American public since the advent of the Bush administration. And, you know, the acting chair's confirmation to be full chair has been held up. Another Republican appointment to the commission has been held up. The new president, whoever that may be, I believe by March of 2009 is going to have four appointments to that commission. Now, the key there is to hold the Senate's feet to the fire and the new president's feet to the fire and make sure that we do not have the kind of passivity on that commission that has been true for the last 8 years. The two Democratic commissioners, Chilton and Dunn, more so Chilton than Dunn, but both of them have been aggressive and been fighting the good battle. But we need young, aggressive regulators in there. And they have all, as you say, they have all the power in the world. There's actually no need for new legislation.
Right.
They have all the authority they need to get this problem fixed. The trouble is the Congress has been put in the position of having to be the executive branch and the congressional branch by tying the hands of a renegade agency through very specific legislation. My hope is that with a new president, we will get a majority on that commission that will use its powers. The fact that Congress has not let these confirmations go through and has used it as leverage to get the CFTC to do things that it otherwise wouldn't do, I think is a very good sign. You're right, that report was a disgrace, but the good news is the ink wasn't dry on it before. It was universal criticism of the quality of that report.
Well, I thank you. I think who is one of our talk show hosts? You're a good American, my friend. You've done a good job.
Well, thank
here.
You. Thank you. Thank you for helping us fight this battle and for your wisdom on the issue.
I appreciate it. And let's just keep an eye out for what's around the corner in the next area that's going to be totally screwed up by somebody that's looking to make a quick buck, you know?
Yeah, well, let's not give up on this corner yet either. We've got to finish this battle out.
Absolutely, absolutely. Hey, thanks so much for coming on, and keep up the great work. And anything you need from my end, I'm here for you.
Good. Nice talking.
Thanks, Professor. Bye-bye. All right, so we go from one disaster to another, and now we're going to pick up on this discussion I was been working on, and it's a work in progress. It's really just the beginning of this, the idea of what can we do to fix the automobile industry, really the automobile industry at a crossroads. If you remember last week or the week before, I had said, you know, if anybody has any ideas, do me a favor. So let me just kind of give you a quick list. I had some help from, and if I left your name off, by the way, forgive me, but I had some help from Bruce and Seth and Toby, Devin, Barbara, Victoria, Stella, Sarah, Ben, Howard, Ron. Who else we got on here? William, Francisco. I'm sure there's plenty more here. Did I say Bruce? I'm going through the list here. Seth. Anyway, there's just a ton of people that wrote in and helped out, and some people wrote on the website, thedisciplinedinvestor.com, about you know, some of their thoughts about it. Give me some good ideas. Maybe we're going to follow up. I am going to follow up. As a matter of fact, we've tried to follow up on some people that they had recommended me contact, and I think that you know, we're waiting for some people to call back. And listen, the fact is that this whole problem, this whole industry is at a crossroads, as I said, and just in shambles. And clearly, by any means, that's an understatement, right? If you look back at all the headlines over time, and particularly over the last two or three years, what do you see? The same thing, loss, loss, loss. And the latest rounds of these losses, I think, have eclipsed anything anyone has ever expected. And if you think about it, you look at just recently back to the GM situation where we saw $15 billion of loss. How does that happen? I mean, you know, who's in charge of this thing? I want to file a complaint, right? So what do we do? Well, clearly something needs to be done, and that's not a new idea, and I'm sure that's nothing that you haven't thought about yourself. Simply, the auto industry has been in need of a serious makeover. We should get them on one of those MTV shows. But we all know that, wait, what is it? Japan was the initial one that started to really steal a significant portion of domestic sales decades ago. Yet, why has it taken so long for the companies here to wake up and really do something about it? Because, you know, now that we've seen shares drop to a point that makes investors question the long-term outlook for companies, why is it now that maybe something's starting to occur? I mean, what happened all of this time? Even so, even as they're looking at this, the multiple layers of expenses, inclusive of the high cost for employee benefits, retirement plan obligations, and of course, any additional incremental expenses due to a word that is going to start making people just start throwing things at their MP3 player, unions. Unions. It doesn't help or encourage investor optimism. So here's my maybe not my entire plan and maybe not the plan that's going to fix everything, but here are some solutions and some ideas that I have that I just question why they haven't been implemented. And some of these are incorporated with the ideas that list of people I mentioned before had sent in to me, and I thank you so much for that. But you just wonder why it has taken so long for such great companies of the past to really step up to the plate and do something about such a dramatic problem that has such severe consequences if it's not addressed. All right, so first, what do we do first? First, we need to deal with the delusion that floor planning makes any sense in its current form. It needs to be totally simplified and I would dare say possibly even eradicated. Showrooms that have the inventories with excessive capacity no longer should be allowed to exist. It's ridiculous that we see such an incredible amount of carrying costs for both the dealer and the company and how much profit that's cutting into. But so just as a point of reference, to be sure the industry will have you believe that this is the only way they can sell cars is to have them available immediately to buyers to take off the lots, you know, once the contract is signed and sealed. But if they begin to move towards a just-in-time manufacturing process, as opposed to guessing at inventory requirements, I think that a dramatic decrease in waste may occur. So in order to accomplish this monumental task, it's going to be very expensive, right? The cost for retooling current manufacturing facilities will be enormous. Yet the long-term financial benefits of utilizing showrooms with kiosk-like ordering systems, which allow for customers to assemble their next car through virtualization systems, will clearly allow for better inventory management. This will also allow for real-time access to current trends that can help manufacturing change on a fly, just to really just, you know, change what they're doing and what they're producing. The idea is to have the showrooms, right, carry in limited inventory, but still have all of the models available in all of the color combinations. Each model can also have a sample of the different options and the configurations, along with basic design packages that are available. Customers can then take the cars for a test drive and see which of the color options and packages really suit their fancy. So back to the cost for retooling the factories. I think this can be partially offset by a change in the manufacturing process and the new model cycle year. Well, here's something that's going to spin some heads. Why not have a new car really designed less frequently? So why are they actually designing new cars every single year? The new cars, which are designed with the idea that each year consumers, you know, they want to buy a new car because of a new design, needs to be trashed, needs to be put aside for the reality of substance over style. No longer are cars bought simply on the fact that, you know, it's, oh my gosh, a new car is coming out, I want to go buy it. The fact is that the reason that consumer wants a new car is now because they need a new car. The new design is great, but management must make a monumental shift of their paradigm and push that through the entire company, that they need to kind of change this whole thinking of the new car design. Advertising teams need to change the message. Rest assured that this can be done. The fact that unless you are one of the relatively small number of enthusiasts today, automobiles are a commodity. And they're really a standard issue. They're a standard requirement of everyday living. Listen, we don't see a new product introduction by Uncle Ben's or annual changes to most basic daily living products, as they're sold with the mindset that the product is what the customer needs and wants. Yet the automobile industry has a fetish with creating a new car design across the entire line of products each and every year. In fact, they're so enamored with this idea that over the years they've actually moved the new car model. Have you noticed that they moved the new car model up? It used to be maybe, let's say, October, November. Then it became a little bit earlier. Now it's in August. August, the new car comes out, months before they actually are due on the market. They forget that the early release was supposed to be used as a temporary marketing tool, not an annual recurrence. Grow or die, man. Change or be changed. The answer is clear. If they continue to deal with the status quo and believe in the status quo, nothing good will come out of this, right? These are the times that require new ideas and a brave management that will embrace a global marketing theater. The annual cost savings to factories and by spreading out the new design cycle and the inventory reduction will ultimately provide, I think, a much better and a greater level of design innovation. The idea is to allow for companies to create a much greater buzz around individual products rather than just, you know, spreading it out there and just giving us any crap they have on an annual basis and call it a new design. Yet even with all of this, and as I said before, a paradigm shift needs to be in order and it needs to occur if the automobile industry is going to understand that they can no longer provide a product that is inferior to global competition. That's the baseline of this discussion. They also need to realize that consumers are looking for ways to conserve energy and reduce the costs associated with the upkeep of the car. They don't get this. It is not our pleasure to pour extraordinary amounts of money into the car and just give you money because you came out with a new design. And realize, hello, realize nationalism is not what it used to be. People are not just buying American anymore. Like it or not, fact is fact. They are buying the car that meets their financial needs and can give them the, what they want on a long-term basis. A case in point here. It's really amazing, as I see it, that it has taken so long to develop a car that has greater level, a greater amount, and a greater fuel efficiency, as it has been well documented that the technology is widely available. Whatever the reason, though, an advancement of fuel efficiency will clearly benefit everyone, yet we haven't seen it in years. And of course, I realize, that change are not going to occur overnight, right? Each company can take a line or a particular product and experiment with how to best move towards a more profitable outcome. Of course, obviously, this has to be done in steps. We're not going to ask the auto industry to change overnight. I mean, they can't change in a decade, much less overnight. But each step can be structured to provide a way to save the company along with the pension and benefit packages for retirees. In fact, one of the biggest problems weighing on the profits right now, and it's really causing a big problem within the entire industry, is the unfortunate situation that has been developing within the retirement and benefit packages, right? We've seen cuts across the board, and we know that for a long time that many of the companies have greater payment obligations to former employees than they do to the current workforce. But no one wants to take money out of retirees' pocket, of course. But something's got to change. And naturally, no one wants to get hard, you know, no one, not you, not me, not a retiree of a automobile company, nobody wants to be hit with a 1 cent reduction to their, you know, pay or retirement benefits. But to be sure, retirees are also not desirous of changing anything that they don't believe that's due them, yet we need to give them just a touch of reality. Simply, here's the point. Something's got to give. If you don't, it's going to be disastrous. And if it doesn't, you know, naturally and miraculously resolve by itself, well, what will happen is the reductions will be much more dramatic in the future. And if anyone believes that this is the worst case scenario and believes that things can't get worse, and if they do, the government of the United States of America will be bailing out the automobile industries because it just can't go down and that guaranteed is just implicit. No dice, my friends. Think about what happened to the transportation company some years ago that had problems with a similar magnitude, right? If anyone here needs to be reminded, look no further than the airlines of 1980s, and in particular, Eastern Airlines, and they closed in 1989. So until we see the industry take major steps to reduce waste and really reduce the overall cost associated with the annual new car model process as well as inventory management, they can figure that they're going to suffer continually. At risk are not only the companies themselves, but realize that the benefits and retirement funds for thousands. So here we go. There's a hint that recently we saw that GM is looking at a 20% reduction or $1.5 billion cost-cutting strategy. And they said that they're no longer providing health care and reducing coverages and benefits to retirees. Well, that's a problem. Sure, the cuts will affect benefits, and they're going to affect employees in other areas. They will also have an effect on a total of almost 200,000 current salaried retirees and their spouses. These are really many who can't take these cuts. They've seen severe cuts in their health coverage going back to 2007. If that's not enough, we've seen a freeze put on health care contributions back to, they froze it to 2006 levels, and the future retirement plan contributions have been reduced significantly. Is this good? No. Am I happy about this? No. But the fact is that unless something is done immediately, this is going to continue and get worse. We are no longer operating in a vacuum. The global competition is fierce, right? And they're smelling blood in the water. By eliminating the lease option recently, there's a sense that there's some thought in the future. Reducing benefits hurts, right? But it's necessary. We need to stay on top of this, one step ahead, or it's going to be the last dance for these big boys. Do you remember when there was the 0% financing? 0% financing. GMAC is giving 0% financing, but paying 8% on their bonds. Hello? How is that happening? No more giveaways that benefit one side of the company and not the other. Profitability across the board, aligned with efficiency, will be the only possible salvation. Do I have the answers? No, not even close. Does anybody? I don't know. But this has gone way too far, hasn't it? I can tell you, if you allow for unions to bully and continue having multiple levels of costs that suck you dry, you will not survive. Management, you need to pull in the reins also and take some responsibility. Millions of dollars of bonuses when the company is losing billions of dollars? I don't think so. Then again, maybe we should let the markets work its ways. If one of the best examples that probably can be drawn to this is Darwinism in the animal kingdom, you know, survival at the fittest, fine. In the end, only the strongest are really going to survive, and the cream will rise to the top. I'm actually looking forward to one day actually going into a car dealership and leaving, feeling like I had a good experience. I don't go, by the way. I won't buy a car. I will go to the websites. I'll find out what's out there, and my wife will check it out a bit, and then I'll buy it from a broker because I will not go to a showroom. I find an appalling and a horrible experience. Every time I'm going in there, I feel, you know, like I'm being sweated down and I'm being lied to. And then I walk out counting my fingers and toes to make sure that I wasn't taken there too. It's about time, don't you think? It's about time we see a significant change here. And if you really deal with some of the basic points, just the basic points of realizing that we need to cut down and consolidate, that's been happening. We need to increase efficiency and customer experience. And that's a mouthful. A lot has to happen there. And I am not the one by any way, any means, to be a fixer. I'm an investor. I'm a simple investor. But when I look at the books and I look at where the expenses are and I look what they're doing and how much they're wasting and I see the interest payments and the costs associated with inventory management and the ridiculous amount of floor planning waste, and if you tell me, if you're going to tell me that the floor planning is paid by the company, well, who the hell do you think we're talking about? I mean, somebody's got to pay for the expense of having a mile long and a mile wide dealership chock full of cars that are not selling. What are you thinking? You cannot put out a car that has 12 to 15 miles to gallon. We see $3 to $4 price of gas. It doesn't work. Get your act together, guys, because until then, I'm not investing. And even if it's a great value play right now, I got to tell you, unless they really do something significant and change, there is no long-term process here that I could say that I'm feeling good about. No way. I would much rather buy a foreign car right now. They operate better, they're more efficient, and they have a better record overall. How about you? Am I a trader? No. Simply buying the best product that's out there. That's capitalism. Nationalism, great. I want the USA, absolutely. If I can buy USA, I will. And I buy USA when I buy stocks every day. But you know what? I'm going to use my judgment when it comes to companies that I am going to buy from an investment standpoint. And right now, I'm not buying these companies. Anyway, that's my rant. That's my discussion. Did I fix anything? No. Did I talk about something that may be a little inspiring to somebody? I don't know. But the fact of the matter is that something really has to be done. If I said 100 times, I've said it once here. Oh, Anyway, we got to listen. We made a little progress with the oil area, right? I don't know. It wasn't our doing, but nonetheless, at least we brought out some understanding, some people, hopefully, and I had a better understanding. And now we have to work on, you know, the aspects of keeping it down right now. And hopefully, if we open our eyes, think through this, and maybe who knows, maybe if nothing else, educate ourselves to some of the options and maybe make us better investors. I mean, that's the best we can hope for. Anyway, this is Andrew Horowitz, and this is, what do we got, episode number 70. And if I haven't told you so, last week I was on Twitch. Check out that podcast. Also go to the Strategy Lab. I'm going to tell you a little something quickly about Strategy Lab. There, if you're looking at what I'm doing in Strategy Lab, it's not an exact duplication of what we have in our portfolios. But nonetheless, one of the things, there's a couple of different rules that we have to abide by there. And that has to do with when we buy. We can't really buy in live time. So I have to be kind of a couple of days in advance, or at least a day in advance. So when you're looking at that, and particularly look at the short on Capital One, if you can see it there, and you'll notice that it was picked up at about, I guess, a couple of points, or at least in the high part of the morning. And unfortunately, it's really very difficult to buy at any other time, or impossible to buy at any other time of the open. So we were kind of caught with a quick downstream of about a buck when we bought it. In real life, we're actually up on that position. But because of the way that the Strategy Lab works, we're up down about 6 or 7% on that position. I don't think that's permanent, but nonetheless, you know, it kind of does skew things. Check that out because it does have a lot of good information in it. I did talk about what's happening with New York State and how I think there's billions of dollars of trouble there and possibly an investment opportunity there at the Strategy Lab for MSN Money Central. And I think next week I'm going to bring to you a discussion that we have to have about the managed growth strategy. If you haven't checked it out, there's a virtual tour available on the site exactly how we manage money. A lot of people ask us, hey, Andrew, can you manage money for me? And we couldn't for a while, but we did open up a special account for people, and they love it. We have a private blog just for them. And check it out over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com and check out the Managed Growth Strategy by us. And there's a virtual tour you can take, and a $50,000 minimum for anybody, but I think that has been going pretty well, actually. We'll talk about that again next week, because I think that what we're going to do is slow down the reservations. We have way too many happening right now. And but if you want to get in, I'm telling you, you better do it quickly, because we're probably going to shut it down for a little while until we can kind of weed through all the reservations that are out there. And all the accounts that are opening up to make sure that we're not doing anything that's going to throw us out of balance and make sure administration can be handled, okay? Until next time, this is Andrew Horowitz. Write me if you want at info@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And don't forget to stick around for next week. I'm going to have a couple of stock tips for you that I think you should be looking at. And we're going to be giving you some things that you could really use, I believe. And I know you like that. We have those surveys that say that you love those stock tips. And, of course, I have a couple of ideas on some things that I'm going to bring to you next week, that one in the water industry and actually one in that could be potentially a good play for the retail industry. We'll see how that goes. But we'll flush that out. I'll let you know. And then I'll bring it to you next week. Thanks for joining me on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. We'll see you real soon.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.